Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a regular series of coronavirus conversations, presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We've been taking your questions to the experts. The whole discussion series is featured on our Facebook page. But we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. Recently, I spoke with Mark Lipsitch, a professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We talked about the Delta variant and children's health. Mark, I want to set up this discussion with a few things that stand out that we've been seeing and experiencing and reading, which is that the Delta variant is continuing to drive a big surge in COVID-19 cases among people of all ages this summer. People who are unvaccinated make up the majority of cases, of new cases, and that includes kids under 12 who aren't yet eligible for shots. In the US, more than 4.5 million children have tested positive for COVID-19 as of this month. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has found that new cases among kids are continuing to increase exponentially. Pediatric ICUs in some parts of the country are filling up with young COVID patients, which is just really horrible and devastating to be learning about. And at the same time, we've heard since the beginning of the pandemic that COVID-19 is unlikely to cause severe illness in children. So there's a lot of differing messaging and experiences that we're learning about. So I want to just start off asking, like, is that still true? What do we know about the virus that causes COVID-19 and the Delta variant and how that affects kids?
Thanks, Alana. Since the beginning of the pandemic, there has been evidence that children are certainly much less likely to get severe disease than adults if they are infected. There's been mixed evidence, some of which we contributed to early on, but has become harder to interpret, that children are less likely to get infected. And that probably is true, but it's a modest effect and also certainly depends on their level of exposure. And so those two things together meant that this was a public health problem mainly in adults and has been a public health problem mainly in adults. And it remains that. That is the vast bulk of the hospitalized and severe cases is in adults. Throughout the pandemic, there has been a sliver of the severe cases that are in children. A few percent of the hospitalized cases have been in people under 18, and that remains true. So compared to adults, children are still at much lower risk, even with Delta, of getting severe disease. Compared to older adults, there's also the fact that those children who are vaccinated got vaccinated more recently, and the vaccine is probably therefore more effective in them right now than the same two doses are in older adults. So children are not, the average child who gets infected is not going to have a severe outcome. Hmm. But the real challenge with Delta is that lots more people are getting infected because it's more contagious. We don't have specific data about contagiousness in children, or not much, but there's every reason to believe that it's more contagious to children and from children than the older variants. And that means that at a societal level, we're seeing higher numbers of cases in all age groups, including in children. That is certainly going to accelerate in the short term as schools open and as the weather gets worse. And so we will have this problem of a large number of infections in children, the large majority of them minor, mild in their effects, but a proportion of them more serious. And as the number of cases grows, the number of severe cases will grow.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that proportionally to all of those infected kids remain a low portion, but because it's growing so much just in terms of surge and whatnot, that we're just going to see more kids infected.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, it sounds like there's just some data you're not sure about yet, or still more to learn about Delta itself in kids.
That's right. The evidence, people have been looking very hard for evidence about what are the differences between Delta and Alpha and the previous variants that we dealt with. The things that are clear about Delta are that in all ages, it is more transmissible. At least we believe that. I haven't seen specific data in children, but all evidence is that it behaves similarly in different age groups. It's more capable of causing disease in people who have been vaccinated if their immune response has waned. And the data from Israel have really begun to paint that picture fairly clearly. And that's mainly almost exclusively a problem in older people and in people who were vaccinated longer ago. And the part that's less clear about Delta is how much more severe the disease it causes is. The only really statistical sample that's been published to date is one from the UK. I think it was around 9,000 people, if I remember correctly. And a few of those were children, maybe 10% or so of those were children. That study found overall in all age groups that Delta cases were about twice as likely to result in hospitalization as Alpha cases from the previous time period, which is an important difference if it's true. Every study has its limitations, and the authors discuss the limitations of that study. Whether that is also going to be true in children is hard to say, but if the ratio between children and adults in terms of hospitalizations remains constant, then that probably means that it's also causing somewhat more severe disease in children. So I think it's reasonable to believe, although we don't have really strong evidence yet, that this may be somewhat more severe in children, but still that's on top of a low baseline.
We've been getting a lot of questions that have been coming in. So I want to just kind of break down a few areas and then go back in and pepper in some of these questions. But do we know anything about how exactly kids are getting COVID? And how likely is it that a vaccinated adult could infect an unvaccinated child and vice versa?
Well, I think kids are getting COVID in lots of ways, just as adults are getting it in lots of ways. We had a case in our household in an adult, no idea where it came from in a vaccinated adult. It happens. And school is clearly one place that they will get exposed, but the household is another place and other activities that kids do as well. In terms of a vaccinated adult infecting an unvaccinated child, in the earlier era of Alpha and fresher vaccinations that had happened more recently, the reduction in the risk of transmitting if you were vaccinated was substantial. We estimated possibly over 90% in one study I was involved with in Israel. The combination of Delta being more contagious and better able to get through vaccine protection has suggested in a number of studies that people probably are infectious when they become infected with Delta, even if they're vaccinated. How infectious is unclear, but it's clearly possible for a vaccinated adult infected with Delta to infect a child. Whether it happens with high frequency is going to be an important research question for the coming weeks.
So it sounds like that's something you're keeping an eye on.
Yeah, it's very hard to study infectiousness, but it is an important thing to study. And what's easier to study is sort of proxies of infectiousness, like the amount of virus in a PCR, viral RNA in a PCR. But we also know from previous studies that that doesn't always predict how much actual virus there is. So the more precise you want to be, the harder it is to do it on large numbers of people. And that's why it's been hard to get data.
I want to ask about vaccines. Pfizer and Moderna have been asked to expand the size of their clinical vaccine trials for children between 5 and 11, who right now are not eligible for vaccines. to improve their ability to detect side effects, which are rare. Where are we now on getting vaccines approved for kids under 12? Do you know when this, do you have a sense of when this might be approved for young kids?
I think the predictions are around the end of this year or maybe early 2022. I don't have any updates to what I read in the newspaper about that. I think there has been a lot of, there have been a lot of calls in the media and elsewhere for an accelerated process. And there's obviously a lot of desire for as much of the population to have access to vaccines as possible, assuming that they're safe and effective. My personal view is that it's that the time being spent to ensure that these vaccines are safe and effective in children is well spent. And as difficult as it is to wait, it would be much worse to find out that that there is a side effect that we hadn't accounted for. Everybody in the vaccine community is focused on the side effect of myocarditis and related outcomes that, especially in young men, seems to be a side effect, a very rare side effect, but a side effect of the vaccine and of the mRNA vaccines. And we don't have data yet on what the risk from the vaccine is in the youngest people. And I think it's FDA's responsibility that they are taking seriously to make sure that we have a handle on that before moving forward. And I approve of that and think that's appropriate.
So it sounds like, let's say your predictions are correct, if it's early next year or spring, that means that no vaccinations this school year for that age group.
Right. No vaccines this calendar year. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense if there's any significance to the full authorization of the Pfizer vaccine in terms of affecting that process or accelerating it? I know that you just mentioned that it's really good to be really, really detailed, obviously, and not skip steps or to move forward too quickly when it comes to these, following these really important issues.
Yeah, I think that the Pfizer full authorization and full approval is a good thing. I think it was sound, based on sound science, and that it reflects the fact that we now have more confidence in the age groups that it's approved for, that it really is safe and effective, and that the small risks that we have quantified are vastly outweighed by the benefits. I think that will have some benefits in getting adults vaccinated who were waiting for that approval. I hope that will be a lot of the people who are still unvaccinated, because vaccinating adults will help to protect children. And it won't be perfect, but it will. Every adult who's vaccinated is someone who's less likely to transmit to children. And so that's where I think this will help. I think the risk-benefit calculation is a different one in children, and therefore it is appropriate to go step by step.
I want to transition to schools, and we're going to get to lots of questions too that relate to this and some of the earlier things that you mentioned about illness in kids. But we're in a huge surge right now, or a recent peak this summer, right as schools are reopening across the country and kids are going back to school, in-person learning. Do you think Delta is the variant may make it more difficult to keep students in the classroom in person? How does this affect things?
I think it will make it more difficult because it's more contagious. I think that how we respond to it will also have a huge impact. And that's in on multiple levels. First, the more adults are vaccinated, the less transmission there will be in schools, because there will be a barrier to transmission. The second, the better we do ventilation and masking and the other things that we know reduce transmission in schools, the better it will be in minimizing transmission and minimizing disruption. I think that's proven science. It's true. It will still be true for Delta, and we should really emphasize those countermeasures as much as we can, including outdoor learning as much as possible when the weather permits, really trying to do what we can to prioritize the huge benefits of school. The next piece that I think is going to be a challenge is figuring out how do we react when there is a case or when there's an exposure.
It's happening.
That we, almost every, we and every, most people we know have seen examples recently as schools are reopening of schools that are already closing down or at least having kids stay home. And we need to reach a balance between trying to make sure there's not large-scale transmission in schools, but also not closing down at the first sight of a case, because that doesn't work.
Do you have a sense of what that balance is or what that level is, or are there these conversations happening in the way that they should be?
I think it really varies across the country, and unfortunately the places that are where ongoing transmission in kids is the most serious in the sense of overloading pediatric intensive care units are also the places by and large where vaccination is lowest and masking is either not common or even prohibited in schools. And so I think some places there's a healthy discussion about it, and I think Massachusetts is doing much better than most. And some places there's a very ideological discussion about it, which is which I think is having bad outcomes for health and is going to end up leading to closed schools at some point because of the burdens.
This question is from Sylvia. Is there any early data on how much the Delta variant is spreading in schools, for example, masked versus non-masked, and other variables like distancing or airflow in what we're seeing?
I have not seen it. It's really, really early. But nothing about Delta suggests that what we learned about Alpha is irrelevant. It might be more transmission under each scenario, but the same things that reduce it for Alpha and previous variants are almost certain to reduce it for Delta and future variants. It's not that big a change in the virus.
This question comes from Andrea. Can you go over the quarantine guidelines or protocols for vaccinated and masked individuals who become exposed to a person with a Delta variant? And I suppose that leads into quarantine protocols for kids too.
So the CDC's recommended quarantine protocols are that an exposure, which means an unmasked exposure of 15 minutes or longer over a 24-hour period at less than 6 feet, both somewhat arbitrary numbers that are just there because we need some way to make the decision. If you have that exposure to where you're unmasked or they're unmasked, then that is counts as an exposure. If you are vaccinated at present, the guidance is that you do not have to quarantine. If you are unvaccinated, the guidance is that you do need to quarantine. I think as we've all observed, public health authorities update their guidance at what seems like a dizzying pace until you need to know something, and then it seems too slow. It's very hard to track, and I think the public health authorities are in a difficult position where it confuses people to change things, but it also, you have to be responsive to the science. I think as the data come in on Delta, it may be that that the definition of vaccinated will change. For example, maybe it will be three doses rather than two, or recent two doses. But I mean, I think we've all known for a long time in the public health world that simple information gets out and is easier to understand than complicated information. But simple is not necessarily how this virus behaves. And change is the rule. So I think it's a challenge for all public health authorities to give guidance that is up to date, but not changing constantly. I'll say that when we had a household case, even though we're all vaccinated, we chose to be more cautious than the CDC guidance and to test ourselves to ensure that we had not been infected.
Thank you for sharing that, because there's always this difference between what you might read in the theoretical and then the reality of how things play out. It just raises a lot of practical questions and uncertainties. This question's from Mitra. My son had COVID in 2020 and has natural immunity. His high school has mandated weekly COVID PCR tests as they view him at risk of infecting others. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it is pretty clear that natural infection does provide a degree of protection, as does vaccination. What is less clear is how much protection, and there are new studies that seem to be different from what we previously thought. But the early studies suggested about a two-thirds reduction in your risk of becoming infected if you previously had COVID, had documented COVID. And so it is not completely protective. It's probably not completely protective against transmission either. Person's son is probably at lower risk than had he not been infected previously, he still is potentially infected and infectious.
This question's from Kimberly about symptoms. I'm particularly interested in any information about the effect of the Delta variant, which you mentioned is still tricky to understand, on children who are immune compromised or medically fragile. And I want to attach this to a somewhat different question from Bill, which is, are there age ranges of kids that are at greater risk of getting seriously sick from COVID?
Well, even among kids, it appears that the older you are, the higher your risk of more severe disease. So youth is protective even within the pediatric age group. I, again, have not seen specific data about Delta and immune compromised or other medically fragile children, but I think that those data will begin to come out quickly. I will say, and there seems to be anecdotally that many of the people who have been vaccinated and had severe COVID in the pediatric age group, or even those who are unvaccinated and had severe COVID, have been those with other predisposing conditions. And that just means that those young people need more attention to try to prevent infection by other means. And also, one can imagine thinking more specifically about vaccination for those who are not vaccinated if they are medically fragile.
Building on that, this question is from Serene. Some viruses like HPV cause medical problems years after the primary infection. Are there any concerns that symptomatic or asymptomatic COVID could cause long-term harm in kids?
I think there is that concern because we don't know. And I think that the HPV example, in a way, is relevant. I think a difference is that there's no indication that this would cause cancer, which is what HPV's major long-term consequences are. It's not that kind of a virus, but it is true that there are examples of viruses that cause longer-term problems, and it is something to be concerned about. But it is until we have a longer experience, we won't be able to say for certain.
I wish you had more answers.
I wish I did too.
I want to just pause to reintroduce myself. I'm Alana Gordon, a reporter at The World, and we're speaking with Mark Lipsitch, epidemiologist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and we are taking your questions, so you can post them about COVID, Delta, and kids. I want to get to this question about globally. There's a few that have come in. We know that globally, you know, there isn't as widespread vaccine access in lower resource countries. And so what does the pandemic and Delta mean for children around the world, and particularly in these regions?
Well, I think it means that the risk of infection is higher, and the risk of being unvaccinated when you get infected is higher, and therefore severity of disease risk is higher. Again, children are by and large at lower risk, but there have been parts of the world in which that seems to be, in which the number of children getting severe disease is higher. And the reasons for that, I'm sorry to keep saying, are not well understood, but it is a very concerning phenomenon. I think everybody in public health and global health agrees that there is a need to vastly expand vaccination around the world. There's been some controversy about whether vaccination of children in the United States is in itself inappropriate given the global demand for vaccines. I think of this as a collective action problem and as a complicated question, in the sense that no single country foregoing vaccines for its children is going to make a substantial contribution to the global total. What we really need is major efforts to expand the total size of the vaccine pool. On the other hand, if everyone takes that view, then everybody will keep their vaccines. And so it's really a classic collective action problem.
That answers a question from Janice. Thank you. Going back to Delta, it might seem obvious or not, but this question's from Andrew. Are the symptoms the same in children as the symptoms of previous variants? Is there a different profile that families should be on the alert for? I know that there's been some look at symptoms of Delta may manifest a little differently in adults compared to the previous versions of this virus, but
yeah,
I'm wondering if you have insights.
Nothing that I think is actionable. I think it's there. If someone does a big study a year from now, there may be some patterns in the statistics, but I don't think it's anything that a parent or a guardian could worry about or would want to change their behavior. It's the same symptoms to a large degree.
One of the questions that came up here is about, you were mentioning this kind of collective action issue about vaccinating the world. And then at the same time, there's this issue within, for example, places in the United States where, you know, vaccine uptake is a challenge. This question from Trina is about vaccination rates among kids who are 12 to 15. They're still low. As of last month, only about a quarter were fully vaccinated. So what can be done to encourage vaccination specifically among these groups?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that is very clear to me and to many others is that hesitancy and access are not two different problems. They're sort of different sides of the same coin. If you make something easier for someone, then their hesitancy has to be really high before it determines their behavior. And if you make something hard for people, then a little bit of, I'm not sure, is enough to dissuade it. So access for kids, the obvious place is schools, and school vaccination is one option. And for those who are not easily reached in schools, or where schools are not the solution, the same things as for adults are relevant, is bringing the vaccines to doctor's offices, to local neighborhoods, through mobile clinics and the like, because it really reduces the barriers. So it's the same, in my view, it's the same as adults, with the extra thing that you can add schools. Mm.
This question is from Lars. It's about vaccinations while pregnant. If a woman gets vaccinated while pregnant, will that protect her baby from infection with the Delta variant? And are there any clinical trials of COVID-19 vaccines in babies, like 6 months and younger?
I don't believe so, in answer to the second question. In answer to the first, we know from nearly all other vaccines, and maybe all other vaccines, I can't think of an exception right now, that maternal immunization, immunization of a mother, even before becoming pregnant, but also when pregnant, can provide antibodies that go through the placenta and protect the baby. I have not seen any data on that in COVID vaccines, but it would be quite strange if that was not the case here as well.
This question is from Steven. Everyone's focused on Delta right now. Do you have any data on other variants and their effects, like Lambda? Or now there's been some questions about newer variants as well that are being identified around the world.
It takes a long time, I mean, a long time meaning weeks to months of having large numbers of cases before you can start to answer those kinds of questions. So the newer variants are much harder to study. And that's just because when you're trying to determine the symptom profile of an illness, you need some standardized way of ascertaining it. So you can't just take those who come in ill because that by its nature is not all of the people. And can ruin your statistical analysis. So you need sort of standardized ascertainment of people and then a way to characterize the symptoms, and that takes some time. So that's why we never really learned that much about beta because it wasn't around for long enough. And Delta's just starting, and the other ones probably people have their eyes on them, but I haven't seen any data.
Thank you for that. Doesn't provide much clarity, but is also humbling to think about this moment that we're in. I also just want to mention I'm seeing some questions come in because I needed to update my list. So there's a few ones that reference great follow-ups to some earlier questions. So I'm going to jump around a little bit. This question is from Christine. It's kind of a practical one, which has come up a lot around me. How do you deal with young kids and masks who do not wear masks correctly 100% of the time? Or are there kinds of masks that kids will want to wear more than others? This may be out of your sphere, but I'm going to
That's
ask
a
it. It
great
came up.
question. My kids are older and don't do what they're told always, but not because they can't. I don't have a good answer to the second part. In terms of the first part, I think, you know, we're all trying to do our very best to keep our families safe, and each minute they're masked is a minute that they're less likely to get infected or transmit infection. And so 90% is really 90% as good as 100%. So, yes, we should all try to encourage proper mask use. No, it's not going to be perfect all the time, even with the best efforts. And people should do what they can. And if that means putting the right superhero on the mask, maybe that'll help. I don't know.
Following up on that, this question is from Scott. What do you think of universal masking indoors in K through 12 schools? I mean, that's a huge range, but especially in areas of high transmission. If you support that, what would be the arguments for that?
I'm quite supportive of that, at least as we begin the school year and see what is possible. I think we should be open to changing because wearing a mask is no one's idea of fun. And we say it's a low-cost intervention, and it is compared to taking someone out of school for a day or some other things, but it is not without cost to people's ability to socialize and take social cues and learn. So I don't think we should just do it and stop thinking about it, but I do think that the value of in-person school is sufficiently great, and the losses when we have to pull out one kid or the whole class is sufficient or sufficiently great that almost anything we can do within reason to reduce that risk is worth doing. And I would much rather see in-person school with masks than schools being shut down left and right because of transmission. So that's the way I think about it.
Do we have any, this is from Kim, any more research available, which I'm guessing you'll say to be determined, or even observations on child-to-child transmission as opposed opposed to like adult to child transmission in the current context of the pandemic?
Not good data that I have seen, I'm afraid.
Okay. Darn it.
I should say there may be some that I'm unaware of from the end of the school year last year, and from summer camp settings. It is hard to keep on top of all the data, and that's not something that I necessarily think I've seen every paper that exists about.
Okay, this question is from Amara. What do you make of test and stay programs that several school districts use, where an asymptomatic close contact will stay in school and get daily rapid COVID tests in order to minimize the number of students out of school in quarantine?
I think that's a really good idea. I think that there's really good evidence that rapid tests are reliable indicators of transmissible virus. They are underused in our country, in my opinion. A lot of other countries, you can get as many of them essentially as you want and use them and then report seamlessly into the national system. That is not true in the United States. We all saw the article about Abbott destroying many of their tests. And you can't go to a local health center and pick up a dozen tests to take home. You can in the UK. Some friends of mine did, and I actually used one last week in New Haven, Connecticut, where they had come back to with their tests. It's really another low cost, relatively low effort way to reduce transmission, to test people and take them out when they need to be out, not when they might need to be out. So I am very much in favor of much more widespread use of testing, not just in schools, but around the workplace and elsewhere.
This is from Katie. What advice do you give parents of toddler age children about airplane travel to areas where COVID rates are higher for family gatherings? Should we be avoiding public exposure as much as possible? And I guess I was thinking about that in terms of going to events or in terms of having the availability of testing in terms of a preventive measure as well.
Well, I think as in the other situations, there are lots of measures beyond vaccination, which is not available to toddlers, to try to reduce their exposure, and outdoors, ventilation, masks on the other people, et cetera, vaccination of the other people, of the adults. So there's lots we can do to try to control the risk. I think we are at some point going to reach a stage where we consider infection of toddlers, possibly before they're vaccinated, to be something that we tolerate the way we tolerate other coronaviruses, which also don't cause severe disease very often, even less often in the youngest people. Maybe we'll get to a point where we're vaccinating all age groups, but I think it's personally think that with a healthy toddler, we should of course try to keep them healthy, but that life also has to go on, and that we may as a society reach the point pretty soon where we decide that having our social lives back under the safest conditions possible with vaccination and ventilation and all of that is worth it, even if that means that some toddlers get infected.
That makes sense from a population level, but it's really difficult to think about from an individualized level and that kind of risk with family, you know, and children to think about that.
Yeah. But we take our children on car trips, and those have risks too. I mean, we are talking about, in the case of toddlers, really, really low risks of infection. And it's not something to seek out any more than we seek out a car crash, but it is something that we can balance against the desire to see our families and other things.
I wanted to ask you a couple more questions. One is just for you, what does a successful year look like for kids as we're seeing a return to school? It's hard to imagine there aren't going to be exposures or outbreaks, partly because that's what's happening. What does a successful year look like to you?
I think a successful year would be one where most where each child is in school for the large majority of the year, and where maybe there's a closure at a particularly intense time, or maybe individual children are out for brief periods of observation if they've been exposed, but better with testing to keep them there. That would be the most successful, and I think there will be a spectrum. In reality, there will be a spectrum, and unfortunately, as with too many parts of health in our society, this tracks income and resources. So the wealthier will be able to afford testing, which should be a public responsibility in my view, but is not. Rapid testing has not been made a public responsibility most places. So that will be resource dependent. The quality of school buildings is resource dependent, but also the impact of being out of school is greater on those who have fewer resources. So there's every reason to try to keep schools going as much as possible for all parts of society.
Will variants, as you see how they are evolving now, make vaccine updating more challenging? And how might developers go about designing vaccines to maintain their protectiveness?
Well, one of the pieces of good news in the Delta story is that it seems that quantity compensates for quality, meaning if you get enough antibodies to the original variant that was in the vaccines, the sequences of which were in the vaccines, then that will work against Delta. And that's why the vaccine effectiveness against children in children who have just been recently vaccinated in the Delta era is quite high. So I think the good news is that we don't have to update every time there's a variant. We do have to keep the vaccine, the antibody levels high, possibly through boosters. But I think what that means is that it buys vaccine developers time to figure out not just can we chase the latest variant, but how do we provide broader immunity so that maybe there are fewer paths of escape from vaccines. I'm sure that there is a lot of work going on to make Delta-based vaccines and other variant-based vaccines, but the positive surprise, and I at least would not have necessarily guessed this, is that just getting more antibodies to the old variants is good enough for the moment.
That is a nice positive note. Just one quick question, we're about to wrap up, which is not quite related to our conversation, which is to note that it was recently announced you'll be helping to establish a new CDC center for outbreak surveillance and predictions. And I wanted to ask before we conclude this full discussion, what are your hopes for that center, a new CDC center for surveillance?
Thank you for the question, and I will say that my comments so far have been as an academic at Harvard School of Public Health, Harvard Chan School of Public Health, not as a CDC person. I am on loan to CDC through a personnel agreement from Harvard for the year, and am working with a team to set up this new Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics at CDC. We're very excited. We've been at it for about 2 weeks now. And the vision for this center is to have a standing capability at the CDC to provide valuable forecasts and analyses of data to decision makers to help them make better decisions. And that's really the goal. It's not only a scientific goal, it's primarily a decision improvement is our function, with science as one of the means to do that. What that means is a range of approaches, including tracking transmission, tracking severity, tracking a lot of the things we've been talking about today. And all of those go into making the kinds of decisions about guidance for schools and about I don't know. Sorry, I think I'm. Did I lose the microphone?
Nope, I can hear you.
Okay.
I can hear you great.
Okay, good. So about decisions like guidance for schools and guidance for vaccine boosters and all of those kinds of questions rely on proper analysis of good data. Our particular focus is on the analysis. The data is another huge problem and project that is being undertaken through the Data Modernization Initiative at CDC. And so there's a lot to do, but I have a I'm working with a really wonderful and very like-minded team that sees these things as crucial. So we're excited to be starting on this and look forward to getting it off the ground.
That was Mark Lipsitch, a professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can view the video of this conversation at our Facebook page, and you can find that at theworld.org/Facebook, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.
From PRX.